This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
People protesting racism. During a pandemic, public health officials understand the need for safety. They also know people need to be heard.
This is a pandemic. It starts and kind of has an end, whereas racism has been here for generations upon generations.
Also ahead, Germany has a stimulus plan to recover from the pandemic, lots of money for electric vehicles, and not for gas-powered cars.
Germany is now moving forward toward building the cars of the future.
And the president of the Philippines says a reporter is a liar. The reporter says she's being muzzled. A court in Manila took the president's side today, and now that crusading journalist faces years in jail.
This ruling puts the Philippine press in the gravest danger.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've seen protests before, but it is unprecedented to see this many people across the globe rallying behind a single issue, ending systemic racism and the police brutality that comes with it, all in the midst of a pandemic that demands social distancing. The Centers for Disease Control this past week even issued new safety guidelines for events and gatherings. Wear masks, stay 6 feet apart, and limit the time of interaction. Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease specialist here in the U.S., told ABC's Powerhouse Politics podcast that he supported people's right to demonstrate for what he called an important social issue.
I respect that. However, I have to, as a public health official, say that is risky.
Still, despite the risks, many public health officials are not as distressed about these large demonstrations as you might think. Here's The World's Ilana Gordon.
Charles Acheman specializes in ethnic and migrant health inequalities at the University of Amsterdam. When he saw the protests mounting across the world, he understood. He'd seen the disturbing images of what happened to George Floyd.
I think that people do have right to protest, because I think that personally, also as a minority, seeing what is happening, not only as a minority, I mean, ordinary human being seeing what is happening, it's just not right.
Lately, Acheman has been studying the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on racial and ethnic minorities in places like the UK, the US, and the Netherlands.
And I think that something needs to be done. And I think that we know that actually discrimination also have a huge impact on health.
He says people have a right to demonstrate, but he also hopes people take care so they don't become a victim of COVID-19.
So it's a very, I would say, a very delicate balance that needs to be struck.
It has been really heartening to see the degree to which other countries have been protesting against racism.
Dr. Oxiris Barbo is the Commissioner of Health for New York City.
My hope is that that will bring all of us as a world that much closer.
Commissioner Barbo says she hopes that as people demonstrate, that they do it safely and reduce risks as much as possible. Her department issued guidelines on this early on. That includes wearing a mask.
Diligent use of alcohol-based hand sanitizer.
Maintain as much social distance as possible when out. Stay around people you know who don't have symptoms. Find creative ways to make noise.
So instead of shouting, which can generate viral particles,
do something like use a noisemaker. Barbo really worries about the enforcement side of protests. Tear gas and pepper spray can create more dangerous situations, as can be arrested and confined in close quarters. Law enforcement officers don't always wear masks. But then there's what happens right after a protest or large gathering.
We want people to make sure they wash their hands, make sure that they remove their face coverings in a safe way, which is you remove your face covering, you put it aside, then you wash your hands. because, you know, if individuals are going back to households where they have, let's say, someone who is over 65, someone who may have an underlying condition, we don't want them to take a risk in exposing their loved one to COVID-19.
Barbo recommends anyone who went to a demonstration get tested 3 to 5 days later.
If there are any concerns about whether or not they may be developing symptoms, the best thing that they can do is to separate themselves until they get their test results or until at least 10 days have elapsed.
Barbo says that so far, based on real-time hospital data in the city, they've not seen an uptick in cases from when the protests erupted in the end of May. But that might take a few more weeks to play out. Jamie Slaughter-Acey is a social epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota. She's also concerned about new outbreaks of coronavirus, but those concerns didn't stop her from visiting the spot where George Floyd died. She visited last week with her 6-year-old daughter.
It had tables in front of it, and it was like hand sanitizer stations. There's messages about trying to be as safe as possible.
It was emotional for her.
All along that, what you're seeing was people in community celebrating the life of George Floyd and paying their respects to George Floyd.
It might at first seem counterintuitive that public health leaders around the globe would not only support people demonstrating during a pandemic, but might even take part knowing the health risks. But many see that racial inequities are closely connected to the pandemic and how it's playing out across the globe.
I don't want it to come off as though the public health profession doesn't care as much about the coronavirus pandemic.
Uchechi Mitchell is a professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago. She is one of some 1,200 health professionals who signed a petition supporting the protests against racism. The petition also included suggestions for how to minimize the spread of COVID-19.
Nobody is ignoring the fact that we have this virus that's plaguing our communities. But this is a pandemic. It starts and kind of has an end, whereas racism has been here for generations upon generations and upon generations, and we're still fighting for this end.
Even the World Health Organization has come out in support of a global movement against racism. For many public health experts, these dual efforts are one and the same. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is setting up a new commission to look at racial inequality in the UK. It comes after 2 weeks of protests in London and other British cities against police brutality and racial inequality, protests prompted by the killing in Minneapolis of George Floyd. Many Black Lives Matter activists in the UK, as well as opposition politicians, are not impressed with Johnson's decree, however. They say the last thing Britain needs right now is yet another inquiry. The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. What exactly did the Prime Minister announce, Orla?
What he announced, Marco, in his own words, was a cross-governmental commission to look at all aspects of inequality in employment, in health outcomes, in academic and all other walks of life. That's how he described it. He made the announcement, by the way, in an article in a conservative newspaper, The Telegraph, this morning. What he doesn't say is who's going to oversee the inquiry, how exactly it'll be conducted, what its remit will be. So details at the moment are very thin on the ground. All we know is that we're due to hear the details of it by December. That's when they're due to report back. But that's literally all the details we have.
So today, the response to this announcement of an inquiry has been pretty lukewarm. What have you heard?
Yeah, just to give you a little context on in this, we have had 5 inquiries over the past 3 years into issues of racial inequality, ranging from schools, hospitals, the justice system, police brutality, workplaces. Many recommendations have been made and very few have been acted upon. So this is the reason for the sense of weariness amongst activists and indeed from politicians themselves. Have a listen to Labour Party MP David Lammy a little earlier. He's a Black MP for London, and he's clearly frustrated at the news.
Get on with the action. Legislate. Move. You're in government. Do something. And frankly, when you watch a man die like we did in 8 minutes 46 seconds, I'd like to ask Boris Johnson why he thinks the way to commemorate his death is to announce yet another commission and why he insists on talking about statues.
Well, right. Talk about statues, as David Lammy there says. A lot of talk about statues in the past few days in the UK, including by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson himself. A statue of Winston Churchill in particular, Orla, has been targeted. Why Churchill?
Indeed, for many people, Churchill is a divisive figure. For Boris Johnson, he's always been a great admirer of Churchill's. He wrote a book about him at some point, and he's described him today as one of the greatest leaders, if not the greatest leader that Britain has ever had. But for others, he's held some very dubious opinions and had some very dubious views. I mean, historians themselves will say Churchill said some very unpleasant things about Palestinians, about Native Americans, and many activists today are saying we need to speak truthfully about what Churchill said back then, what David Lammy is referring to as well, are these protests that happened in London this weekend by far-right activists who came and they said they were coming to defend the statue of Winston Churchill. There's been calls by some Black Lives Matter activists to take down the statue of Churchill from the centre of London.
No doubt that debate is not going away anytime soon. The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you've got kids, you probably have one thing on your mind. Is school opening this fall? And if it is, what's that going to look like? This spring, schools were closed in 146 countries. That's according to UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Some countries have already sent kids back to school. Joining me now to explain how is Stefania Giannini, the Assistant Director General for Education at UNESCO. She joins us from Florence, Italy. Stefania, what are different countries around the world doing to protect students and teachers? Like, are you seeing places that are doing well on this right now?
As you know, UNESCO started to monitor the process of school closures all around the world, and we reached a peak of 1.6 billion students 1 month ago, more or less, when 92% of the student population were out of school because of the COVID-19. So now it's time for governments, school communities to decide to reopen. But the longer schools stay closed, the higher the risk of learning loss for the most disadvantaged students in particular.
So are you seeing examples of places that are really taking this concern seriously and have some guidelines that you think are practical for their kids? What countries are doing that?
I can mention France, which is reopening all school systems from next week. And they started progressively from the little children, the primary schools, with very strict measures. For instance, a classroom with 22 students to come back with 9 of them. So health first. This is may be the summary that all countries are taking into account.
So what are they doing in Italy right now, Stefania, where you are?
Italy decided to postpone reopening schools after summer. But let me say that we are still very early days in this process, because in our data, only about 20 countries in the world have actually reopened schools.
So what advice do you have just practically for parents about what they should be asking their own school systems?
First, of course, to be sure that their children going back to school can find a safe condition for learning. Second point is about taking this crisis as a good opportunity to make our education systems more resilient, more flexible. For instance, investing very much here and now, not tomorrow, in education, starting from teachers, which are the core pillar of the education process.
Stefania Giannini is Assistant Director General for Education at UNESCO. She's been speaking with us from Florence. Thank you very much, Stefania.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Asia, where the new coronavirus originated, most countries sealed their borders months ago. But now some of those countries are talking about opening things up a bit. Not to everyone, just people coming from other countries that have done a good job containing the virus. On Friday on the show, we looked at how this idea is getting traction in Europe. Today, we turn our focus to Asia. In Bangkok, here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
One of the world's busiest airports is in South Korea, near Seoul. But more recently, it's been a ghost town. Yeah, basically empty. The YouTuber who posted this video in May says it was eerily quiet. And that goes for a lot of airports. COVID-19 has squeezed the life out of foreign travel. But now governments across Asia are desperate to open up. So they're talking about travel bubbles. One country looks to another, says, seems you've got this virus under control. We'll let your people come over, no hassle, no quarantine.
Then within that bubble, it is considered to be quite safe. It's almost like traveling within one country.
Masato Takamatsu is a business consultant who specializes in tourism catastrophes. And his native Japan has definitely been through one of those. The tsunami 9 years ago in Fukushima, which caused a nuclear reactor to melt down. Lots of people did not want to come to Japan after that. But what's happening now with COVID-19, Takamatsu says this is worse.
But now the pandemic is another story. The entire world is affected. In comparison with that previous experience, I think the pandemic is much more difficult to overcome.
But travel bubbles, he says, are the way to do that. Officials in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, they're all looking at this concept because all those places have very few COVID-19 cases. So why not open up, at least to each other? Here's another easy place to do a bubble, Australia and New Zealand. They're both islands, they get along. They may have a bubble going by September. Done. Here's a tougher one, Japan and China. Now that's a big bubble between two countries that don't always get along. But they're two of the biggest economies in the world. Takamatsu says it's a no-brainer. And he says it does help that China has a surveillance state.
They have the nationwide system to identify who is positive and who is negative of the virus.
Now this is key. Both countries have to trust their bubble buddy to track their own citizens and to know if travelers are infected. Japan, despite having a competent government and good public health care, they actually don't do much testing.
Unless you have some kind of symptom or very close contact with a virus positive person, you cannot get a test. So that's the challenge. There's no proof that you are safe to travel.
So China could say, hey, Japan, step up your testing or no bubble for you. Other potential bubbles in Asia? Well, the busiest border crossing on Earth is between Malaysia and Singapore, so that one is likely. Just don't expect many countries to make a bubble with the United States, which is seen as doing a bad job handling the virus. Though Takamatsu says Japan may make an exception for one U.S. state that, like Japan, is also a group of islands with not many cases.
This is not a country, but the state of Hawaii is also interested in forming the travel bubble with Japan.
Most of these bubbles are in the conceptual stage now. But forming bubbles is tricky. Lots of legal and political issues to hash out. Takamatsu says governments that want to get bubbles going before the end of the year, they should start working on it now. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
This month, Germany released a stimulus plan to help the country recover from its coronavirus lockdown. The nearly $150 billion plan is being called one of the greenest in the world. Big pots of money are going to public transportation, electric vehicles, and renewable energy. Notably missing in the automotive heartland of Europe, money for the auto industry to shore up the business of making gas-powered vehicles. Here to discuss this is Inside Climate News reporter Dan Guarino. Were you surprised to see that there were no bailout funds for the powerful German auto industry, Dan, except for electric vehicles?
Yes, it certainly does at this point look like things are different. This is not the way it would have gone 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Yeah, this is different.
Germany is known as a leader in the transition to renewable energy. In a recent article, you argue that despite great progress in renewables, the biggest block to even greater energy progress in Germany has been the automobile industry. So what is the history behind why the German car industry has so much power in Germany?
The German car industry is at the heart of German culture. This was a major source of jobs. It was a major engine for the economy. When the country was making this broad shift to clean energy, it's as if they couldn't bring themselves to realize that that meant the automotive sector needed to change in a really big way.
How precisely were efforts to cut emissions undermined because of the political power of the auto industry?
The EU is leading the way in terms of carbon emission regulations. Now, Germany plays a oversized role in that. In the case of the German auto industry, they had this gigantic benefit, this gigantic help in keeping those rules weak, which is that the German government was essentially acting like an advocate in a way that undermined the process.
I guess a turning point for all of this came after the VW so-called clean diesel scandal that was in 2015. Remind us what happened then and how that set off a national policy change in Germany.
Volkswagen was talking about so-called clean diesel, this incredibly environmentally friendly technology, but they were cheating the emissions testing. And they seemed to think that they would never get caught. But of course, they were caught in 2015. I spoke with Dorothy Zahr, a staff member for one of the leading environmental advocacy groups in Germany, about what the diesel scandal meant.
That really caused a trembling. People became quite angry because they saw they're being betrayed, so to speak.
No longer was the German government and its auto industry in lockstep. All of a sudden, you were seeing the government act more like a government should when dealing with the leading industry. The automakers, led by Volkswagen in many ways, said that they were going to much more aggressively pursue electric vehicles. A key moment here is in 2019 when Herbert Diess, the chief executive of Volkswagen, made an announcement that the company wanted to make a much more swift transition to electric vehicles.
Ladies and gentlemen, Volkswagen will change fundamentally. Some of you may still be rubbing your eyes in amazement, but there's no question, this supertanker is picking up speed.
So what does it signal, do you think, for the future of the car industry in Germany, the shift that you're describing?
Germany is now moving forward toward building the cars of the future. This is a dramatically different environment, and it makes it so that you can see the potential for Germany's auto industry to be a world leader 20 years from now, 30 years from now, in a way that was difficult to imagine before.
Dan Guarino is an energy reporter with Inside Climate News. You can read his story on Germany, cars, and climate policy at theworld.org. Dan, good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
You tune into the show every weekday to hear stories that connect you to the world. That connection continues on social media. That's where you'll find our team of journalists. Join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking, discuss, and share. Follow us on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. Slam your finger in the door. Even the most polite among us are going to unleash some four-letter words. Scientists have studied the potty mouths and have concluded, let it rip.
People who swore, they were able to withstand the painful stimulus, the ice cold water, for 33% longer.
Permission to swear, that's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Today, after 13 years on the run, a Sudanese militia leader faced his day in court. Ali Kusheib made his first appearance at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. It's a milestone for the tribunal, which has come under attack from the Trump administration. Kusheib is charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the Darfur region of Sudan. The World's Halima Gikandi brings us the story.
When Mutasim Ali thinks about his childhood in Darfur, he remembers a quiet, normal life. He was born in the village of Dabanira in the mountainous Jebel Mara region. He spent most of his time at school or on the farm. Then in 2003, everything changed. He was 16 years old.
And then when the war broke out, my family and I were separated because the village was destroyed.
The militia in Darfur was known as the Janjaweed, an Arab militia supported by Sudan's government. Janjaweed fighters burned and systematically killed indigenous Africans in Darfur. An estimated 300,000 people or more were killed, and more than 2 million people were displaced from their homes, including Ali and his family.
They are now living in a displaced persons camp in North Darfur state.
Ali hasn't been back to Darfur since. He fled Sudan's capital, Khartoum, after being arrested for criticizing the government. Eventually, he made his way to Washington, D.C. It was there that he heard the news that one of the alleged leaders of the Janjaweed, known as Ali Kushaib, had been arrested and was going on trial at the International Criminal Court.
I was very happy because, you know, Ali Kushaib, you know, surrendering himself to ICC is an important step to satisfy the victims of genocide.
Kushaib made his first appearance at the ICC today as part of preliminary trial proceedings. He was asked if he understood the more than 50 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. He said he was aware of the charges, but they were untrue. This is only the first step of what is likely to be a lengthy trial, but it comes at an important time for Sudan. The country is trying to move towards democracy and beyond the legacy of former President Omar al-Bashir. He was ousted from power last year after widespread protests. While Sudan has made some important social and political changes, some say the Darfur region has not. That's how Yahya Shugar feels. He's a doctor in West Darfur.
For me, the situation of Darfur, it's still in bad condition.
Shugar is part of an effort to stop the spread of coronavirus in Darfur, which is seeing a rise in cases. But the disparities in the war-torn region are making it difficult. Millions of Darfuris remain in displacement camps. They tend not to trust the Sudanese government, Shugar says, because some officials in power are still linked to crimes committed in Darfur.
As people deny there is a coronavirus in Sudan or in Darfur, you know, people say there is a political issue, there is no coronavirus here.
He knows that's not true. But on top of that, Darfur is still seeing widespread insecurity and violence. Civilians have been attacked on a weekly basis. Rebel groups in Darfur formed to fight the Janjaweed have been actively negotiating with the Sudanese government. They're trying to address the long-standing problems in Darfur. Nimer Abdulrahman is one of the chief negotiators in those talks.
You know, our main problem in Sudan is to address the root cause of the political problems.
He says one goal is to help displaced people and refugees return to the homes they left nearly 20 years ago. Another goal is to disarm militias that continue to attack civilians. And most of all, to bring justice to those accused of war crimes in Darfur.
The government in Khartoum should handle over those wanted by the International Criminal Court. That is, we agree. And from those who is not indicted, we are agreed to establish a Darfur Criminal Court.
Abdulrahman says former President Bashir, as well as some members of the current Sudanese government, all need to go on trial. Negotiations between rebel groups in Darfur and the government of Sudan are continuing this week. A final deal could be reached by the end of the month. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
In the Philippines today, a court has dealt a heavy blow to press freedom, and it puts crusading journalist Maria Ressa once again in the spotlight. Ressa, who's Filipina-American, has been a prominent critic of Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte. The president and his supporters have accused her of reporting false information. Ressa says the attacks against her are politically motivated. Today, a judge found Ressa guilty of the charge cyber libel. Ressa now faces up to 6 years in prison.
This ruling puts the Philippine press in the gravest danger.
That's Virgil Santos. He's a veteran journalist in the Philippines. Santos now chairs the Center for Media Freedom and Responsibility in Manila.
And this is the first case of cyber libel tried in court. The main feature, apparently, of this new law is that if you post anything online, you can arrest easy for 12 years. Meaning the period of prescription is 12 years, unlike in the normal case, which is only one. In normal libel, you lose your chance to sue after a year. But you know how it is. I mean, they always find a way to twist things technically.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you, you're a journalist, Virgil. What do you make of the charge of cyber libel being used by the government to arrest somebody like Maria Ressa? What's your take?
Not only Maria Ressa, but anyone. We all know that all media are now migrating to cyberspace, if not already there. And therefore, all media will be subject to this law.
Explain what happened then with this particular case of Maria Ressa. What is she actually charged with here?
She's charged with libel for supposedly ruining the reputation of some businessman. The businessman took 5 years, by the way, to feel aggrieved enough to sue. And President Duterte and this accuser happens to have common cause. They both don't like Rappler.
Rappler is Maria Ressa's outlet. Remind us and our listeners, Virgil, who Maria Ressa is.
She retired to her native land to put up Rappler. And at the time when the news media now and then would come under siege, you know, it was a good time for someone like Maria to come and do her journalism.
We've had her on The World several times. This is a moment from a recent interview I did with her, and I think we'll get a better sense of just her energy and what her mission is.
We just have to, now more than ever, hold the line. There's a saying in Indonesia, you know, the nail that stands up gets the hammer. That's the rough translation, right? It wasn't my choice to be targeted. We weren't the first to be targeted. We call a spade because now when facts are debatable, we need to tell the stories. So we continue to do that.
We get a pretty good sense of Maria Ressa's determination there to dig and find the truth in the Philippines. Do you think this verdict is a surprise, Virgil?
No, I'm not surprised at all. The largest broadcast network in this country, which is in the process of losing its franchise, and the widest circulated newspaper as well. All three have been doing bolder journalism than other outfits.
So, Virgil, how far-reaching will this ruling be in the Philippines? Will there be a ripple effect? I mean, either more arrests or a silencing of other journalists?
This calls for a bolder exercise of the profession. And I will not be surprised if such bolder practice could be met with equal measure. Please understand that we are in the thick of a pandemic ourselves, and we are unable to go out. And if you look out there in the streets, you know, the streets are crawling with police and military people, supposedly, to keep peace and order in these pandemic times. Mr. Duterte has militarized the civilian government.
Virgil Santos is a Manila-based journalist with the Center for Media Freedom and Responsibility. He's been telling us about the verdict against Maria Ressa of Rappler Media. Thank you very much, Virgil. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When you stub your toe, there's nothing like letting out a good Turns out there's more to this release than you might think. Researchers have found that swearing can actually increase a person's pain tolerance. And no, you can't substitute in a PG version like "oh fudge." Only the real thing will do. Ollie Robertson is a psychology researcher at the University of Oxford and also works at the Swear Lab at Keele University, both in the UK. First of all, the Swear Lab, are you all in lab coats and just dropping F-bombs on each other?
I wish it was that exciting.
So what are you doing at the Swear Lab? And how did you find out that swearing can increase a person's pain tolerance?
People take swearing for granted. It happens quite a lot. A lot of us do it most days. But we don't really think about how it might affect our bodies, how it might affect our social relationships, or what it means for the real world. And that's what we're interested in, making this somehow mundane-seeming everyday behavior and looking at how important it is in real life.
What was the experiment you used to find out how this actually worked?
So for the pain tolerance and threshold study, we got participants to come into the lab and submerge their hand into ice-cold water. And we asked them to keep their hand in the water for as long as possible. And we asked them to repeat one of four words. So we had the good old F-bomb, we had a control word, and then we also had two made-up swear words. So we had the word fouch, and the second word was the word twizpipe. The reason why we chose that word is
there's an idea that swearing might have a beneficial effect because it's funny and it distracts you. And we thought that twiz pipe was a funny sounding word.
Is that a nonsensical word? It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. Okay. Both fouch and twiz pipe are nonsensical words. And we found, as you said earlier, people who swore, they were able to withstand the painful stimulus, the ice cold water, for 33% longer than any of the other words.
What's the thinking behind this? I mean, can you explain why that is?
One of the exciting things about swearing research is that we're really at the beginning of understanding how and why this works. So the two theories in the literature to date, one says that it's the parasympathetic nervous system. And what happens there is once you've dealt with a stressor, so once you've dealt with something that has stressed your body out, stressed you out, it's been upsetting, the parasympathetic nervous system comes in and puts the chill factor on everything. So your heart rate comes down, it allows your body to rest and recover and gain all the resources back. The other side is the one that you'll probably know better, the sympathetic nervous system, and that's known as the fight or flight response. And that's where your heart rate increases, where you can deal with a stressor evolutionarily to run away or to deal with it. Now, we don't know whether these are two mutually exclusive processes, so whether or not they work completely separate to each other, or if they work in tandem to help you overcome what's happened.
You know, Ollie, you're making a really compelling argument for the benefits of swearing. But here's the thing. We're told as kids to use polite language, don't use dirty words. So how do you get society to accept a practice that actually seems to be good for our health?
I think it's about understanding that these words are powerful and that these words aren't always used for good. So recently in the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a police officer in San Diego who I believe he's been investigated for, amongst other things, for swearing at protesters. Swearing in this instance was used as a form of oppression because it's a power play. What he was doing was he was swearing at protesters in the way that they couldn't swear back, because in America and in the UK, swearing at a police officer can be a form of assault and you can be arrested for this. And we know that when people of power use swearing in an aggressive way in situations where the minority group don't have the opportunity to react, it forces the minority groups to be silent. So there are things about swearing that are negative that we do need to understand, and understand what this piece of language fulfills as a function.
Ollie Robertson is a psychology researcher at the University of Oxford. She also works at the Swear Lab at Keele University in England. Thank you very much, Ollie.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Swearing can be cathartic. So can this. A good scream. In cities across Switzerland on Friday, hundreds of thousands of marchers at the annual women's strike shared a very different kind of scream, a mass scream. The scream started at 3:24 p.m. and lasted for a full minute. That particular time of day is symbolic. 3:24 p.m. is the moment when Swiss women technically start working for free. By 3:24, the average Swiss man has earned what the average woman will earn in an entire workday. In Switzerland, women earn about one-fifth less than the men. The Swiss strikers were also protesting domestic violence in Switzerland. There was a minute of silence to remember women killed by their partners. 19-year-old student Roxane Errico told Reuters that she was there for her mother, who was killed by a violent boyfriend. Errico said, "I scream for me, but I also scream for my sisters and brothers. I scream for all the other children who lost a mother or a father. And I also scream for my mother, who would have screamed with me if she was still here." The women's strike has been held every year in Switzerland for the past 30 years. Earlier today, in a Russian court, an American citizen, former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, was sentenced to 16 years of hard labor on spying charges. U.S. and other Western officials have questioned the charges and the legitimacy of the court proceedings. Reporter Charles Maines was at the courtroom earlier today, joins us from Moscow. First of all, remind us, Charles, who is Paul Whelan? What's his story and how did he end up in Russian custody?
So yeah, Whelan was director of global security for Michigan-based auto parts supplier, a company called BorgWarner. He spent 4 years in the U.S. Marine Corps before being discharged in 2008 for bad conduct. That's according to the military. But he was really interested in Russia, and he traveled here a lot over the past decade. His recent problems began in December 2018. Whelan was arrested by FSB security agents after allegedly accepting classified materials on a computer thumb drive in a central Moscow hotel right on Red Square. Whelan always denied the charges, said he was in Moscow for a friend's wedding, accepted the drive from a Russian friend without ever knowing or viewing its contents, and he's been waiting for his day in court ever since, saying he's been mistreated by guards, denied health care, in what he has colorfully labeled a sham trial and a Moscow goat rodeo.
So the news today, Charles, Whelan was sentenced in a Moscow court. What did you see? You were there.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. This has been a closed hearing for the past few months. So probably most interesting was actually to finally see Whelan in person. It's been a while. You know, Whelan's been on these espionage charges now for the year and a half. Certainly the last final phase has been closed to the public, and not only the public, also to consular officials. So I was in the courtroom today with consular officials from the U.S., from Canada, from U.K., from Ireland, because Whelan holds passports from all four countries. And as we entered the courtroom, Whelan was in a glass cage and had this to say about his case.
This is slimy, greasy, grubby Russian politics. Nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah, Charles, just in case anyone couldn't hear it, he said this is slimy, greasy, grubby Russian politics.
That's right. That's right.
So 16 years is the length of a sentence. Is that surprising? What should we read into that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the guilty verdict was expected. As you know, he got 16. Prosecutors were asking for 18 years. And certainly that does seem to be kind of a staple of the Russian court system, where they give a little bit less than what prosecutors are asking for to make the system look a bit lenient.
How are U.S. authorities responding to this whole saga?
Well, we heard from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today released a statement that the U.S. was outraged over what it called a secret trial. In other words, this closed-door hearing we were talking about. It said he had serious concerns that Mr. Whelan was deprived of fair trial guarantees. And that was a message largely echoed at the courthouse by the U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Sullivan, as well.
I've described these proceedings as a mockery of justice, and today just confirmed it. An American citizen has been sentenced to a term of 16 years for a crime for which we have not seen evidence.
Charles, are Russian politicians commenting on this case, or is the Whelan story and their opinions on it strictly for the Russian courts?
Well, we heard from the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He knocked back this idea that Whelan was somehow a political prisoner or this was a politicized case. Essentially, he said that Whelan was charged, evidence was presented, and a judge convicted him.
So, Charles, what are the larger political implications here? Because it feels really big. An American gets 16 years on spying charges in Moscow with flimsy evidence.
Yeah, it's an irritant, certainly, to already bad relations between the U.S. and Russia. That was something that Ambassador Sullivan touched on today. But he also said that, look, you know, the Russian-U.S. relationship is much wider than just Paul Whelan. They have other things to deal with, including arms control in the coming weeks. In fact, they'll be meeting in Vienna in a few weeks. So he says, look, this is something that just has to be raised going forward, and they're going to keep working towards getting Paul Whelan's freedom. Now, it's interesting that from the very beginning of this case, there were rumors that somehow this was about some kind of future prisoner swap between the two countries. And this was something that Whelan mentioned in the courtroom after the verdict was read today. He said that Russia was interested in trying to free two Russian nationals who are in U.S. prisons right now. One is an arms smuggler named Victor Boot, who was convicted by the U.S. in 2011. He's serving out a 25-year term. Another is a Russian pilot who was found guilty of conspiring to smuggle cocaine to the U.S. in 2011. He's serving out a 20-year term. And even Whelan's lawyer today said that, you know, nobody's hiding it, that they're hoping for possibly a trade, or if not, they may look to President Putin for a pardon as well.
We'll see what happens. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This weekend, I spent 5 minutes trying to plan a week somewhere quiet this summer, you know, a vacation. I quickly gave up because everything is just so uncertain. I'm just going to do the staycation, take walks, read, travel vicariously through high-definition video and photos of extraordinary places around the world, or musically in my mind, the way this woman does.
My name is Leticia Tamko, and I write music under the name Vagabond.
Never meant to be you, never meant to be me, never meant to be us. Never meant for all of this, never meant for you to love, never meant for you to trust.
At the age of 13, Vagabond moved with her family from Cameroon in Central Africa to New York City. Her stage name, Vagabond, well, she got tired of trying to pronounce Leticia Tamko. Plus, she wanted a name that would convey her sense of adventure and discovery.
Vagabond, like I was kind of always known since I was a kid as kind of a wanderer and a
person who was always curious and wanted to always go somewhere and couldn't stay in place.
English did not come easy when Vagabond first arrived in the U.S. as a young teenager. She spoke French. Expressing herself came more easily through music. Her parents bought her a guitar. She taught herself to play and began writing songs, performing and recording them, and sharing them online.
It really waters me down.
So what do you remember of music in Cameroon?
I remember a lot of live music. My grandmother is a choir director in Yaoundé, and the music happened very organically. It was, everyone was feeling something and they were playing, you know, whether it's hand drums, but mostly a lot of singing, a lot of harmonizing. And that's what I remember being my first memory of loving music. My mom had all her friends over on a Sunday and they were all singing and harmonizing. And my mom wouldn't consider herself musical at all. And I got into the middle of all these people who were giant and started singing and dancing. And that music, whether it's church music or just these traditional melodies and rhythms, they just came to everyone, whether they identified as a musician or not.
A memory from childhood in Yaoundé, Cameroon, becomes ethereal lo-fi in New York City. Here's a track called Home Soon from Vagabond's debut release. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. When we're not here on your radio, you'll find us online at theworld.org. And on Twitter, we are at The World. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.